University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. June Examination Session 2009. English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you're doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at questions 1 to 6. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. What is grandmother's address?
I'm collecting some medicine for my grandmother. She has signed the form to explain that I'm her representative.
Please can you confirm her name and address for me?
Mrs. B. Brown, spelled B-R-O-W-N-E, and she lives at 20 East Road. I'm collecting some medicine for my grandmother. She has signed the form to explain that I'm her representative.
Please can you confirm her name and address for me?
Mrs. B. Brown, spelled B-R-O-W-N-E, and she lives at 20 East Road.
Question 2. What will happen if the visitors miss the boat at midnight?
Return tickets for the boat to Monte Grand Island, please. We are a group of 4 adults and 6 children.
It's €2 for each adult and the children are half price. So that's €14, please.
Thank you. When is the last boat back to the mainland, please?
Midnight. If you miss it, you must stay on the island until the first boat at 5 a.m.
Return tickets for the boat to Monte Grand Island, please. We are a group of 4 adults and 6 children.
It's €2 for each adult and the children are half price. So that's €14, please.
Thank you. When is the last boat back to the mainland, please?
Midnight. If you miss it, you must stay on the island until the first boat at 5 a.m.
Question 3. How might the people in the shop be able to help the friends? Give 2 details.
Oh dear, it's so dark. I'm sure we've missed the turning to Jim's house. The party will be over soon.
Okay, let's stop and ask the way at that shop over there. They might have a map of the area.
Yes, or they might let us telephone Jim and ask for directions to his house. Oh dear, it's so dark. I'm sure we've missed the turning to Jim's house. The party will be over soon.
Okay, let's stop and ask the way at that shop over there. They might have a map of the area.
Yes, or they might let us telephone Jim and ask for directions to his house.
Question 4. Why does Jean want the car race to take place as scheduled?
Paul, it's so foggy that we can't even see the track.
Don't worry, Jean.
If the race doesn't take place today, it will be timetabled for tomorrow. We can use our tickets again then.
I've got an exam tomorrow.
Let's hope the weather clears then, and they hold the race today.
Paul, it's so foggy that we can't even see the track.
Don't worry, Jean. If the race doesn't take place today, it will be timetabled for tomorrow. We can use our tickets again then.
I've got an exam tomorrow.
Let's hope the weather clears then, and they hold the race today.
Question 5. Why is the group taking a break?
Listen, everyone, please. We have scheduled a one-hour break here for you to do some sightseeing. Meet back here in an hour. This is Castle Square. You may wish to have a cool drink, some water or lemonade, as it's so hot. Listen, everyone, please. We have scheduled a one-hour break here for you to do some sightseeing. Meet back here in an hour. This is Castle Square. You may wish to have a cool drink, some water or lemonade, as it's so hot.
Question 6. Why might the building work mean that the friends miss their train? Give 2 details.
According to the map, the station should be here, but this looks like a building site.
Look at this sign. The station is being modernised. We have to use the side entrance, which is a couple of streets away. Run, or we'll miss the train.
According to the map, the station should be here, but this looks like a building site.
Look at this sign. The station is being modernised. We have to use the side entrance, which is a couple of streets away. Run, or we'll miss the train.
That is the last of questions 1 to 6. In a moment, you'll hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. Listen to the following interview about a flying saucer and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
No more sitting in traffic jams. Now you too can beat the rush hour queues. How? You simply fly over them. The inventor of a new commercial flying saucer is here to tell us how. Professor Stravinsky, welcome to our programme.
Yes, I have been working on a flying saucer. It works like a family car, but lifts passengers above the road and then speeds to the required destination.
It sounds as if it's the ultimate way to beat rush hour delays.
Thank you. It could be.
And is it really a flying saucer?
Yes. Known as the M200G, my vehicle is shaped just like a flying saucer. We have been building it for 40 years in California, and in about 6 months' time, you'll be able to buy one of your own.
Incredible! How much will it cost to own a flying saucer?
$75,000. And you'll have to go on a waiting list, because we can only produce 250 per year at the moment.
Is it difficult to drive, or should I say fly?
No, it's easy. The saucer hovers like a helicopter at 3 meters above the ground. Any higher than that, and the driver would need a pilot's license, but that's another matter. There is plenty of legroom, and you can take a passenger too.
Do you think a lot of people will want to buy this wonderful invention?
Of course. Look at how congested city roads are becoming. I have a vision of a highway in the sky. It would cut our commuter traffic in half at least, and at present the area just above our heads isn't used at all.
So what do we put in the fuel tank of our flying saucer?
Petrol, diesel, or even ethanol, a fuel made from corn. It's your choice. The saucer is powered by 8 engines. Ethanol, the corn fuel, would be the most economical for the driver.
I suppose your invention would be good as a rescue vehicle too, since it can reach inaccessible places and can easily hover over traffic queues.
Yes, I do hope so. We have conducted 200 test flights with this idea in mind.
Do you have to carry out tests at an airport so that there's a runway available for takeoff?
No. The flying saucer uses vertical takeoff and landing, so there's no need for a runway or even much space.
So quite soon we'll literally be able to drop in on our friends or the shops?
Yes. We're currently in talks with 2 agencies, the Aviation Authority and the Ministry of Transport. And at the moment, neither can decide which one will authorise the vehicle.
I see. So what's your next invention going to be?
My proper flying car.
Oh!
You'll be able to drive that both on the road and high in the sky. It will be able to climb 2,000 metres per minute and travel up to 400 kilometres per hour. But that's not for another decade, at least.
I'll look forward to flying it.
Now you will hear the interview again.
No more sitting in traffic jams. Now you too can beat the rush hour queues. How? You simply fly over them. The inventor of a new commercial flying saucer is here to tell us how. Professor Stravinsky, welcome to our programme.
Yes, I have been working on a flying saucer. It works like a family car, but lifts passengers above the road and then speeds to the required destination.
It sounds as if it's the ultimate way to beat rush hour delays.
Thank you. It could be.
And is it really a flying saucer?
Yes. Known as the M200G, my vehicle is shaped just like a flying saucer. We have been building it for 40 years in California, and in about 6 months' time, you'll be able to buy one of your own.
Incredible! How much will it cost to own a flying saucer?
$75,000. And you'll have to go on a waiting list, because we can only produce 250 per year at the moment.
Is it difficult to drive, or should I say fly?
No, it's easy. The saucer hovers like a helicopter at 3 meters above the ground. Any higher than that and the driver would need a pilot's license, but that's another matter. There is plenty of legroom and you can take a passenger too.
Do you think a lot of people will want to buy this wonderful invention?
Of course. Look at how congested city roads are becoming. I have a vision of a highway in the sky. It would cut our commuter traffic in half at least, and at present the area just above our heads isn't used at all.
So what do we put in the fuel tank of our flying saucer?
Petrol, diesel, or even ethanol, a fuel made from corn. It's your choice. The saucer is powered by 8 engines. Ethanol, the corn fuel, would be the most economical for the driver.
I suppose your invention would be good as a rescue vehicle too, since it can reach inaccessible places and can easily hover over traffic queues.
Yes, I do hope so. We have conducted 200 test flights with this idea in mind.
Do you have to carry out tests at an airport so that there's a runway available for takeoff?
No. The flying saucer uses vertical takeoff and landing, so there's no need for a runway or even much space.
So quite soon we'll literally be able to drop in on our friends or the shops?
Yes. We're currently in talks with two agencies, the Aviation Authority and the Ministry of Transport. And at the moment, neither can decide which one will authorise the vehicle.
I see. So what's your next invention going to be?
My proper flying car.
Oh!
You'll be able to drive that both on the road and high in the sky. It will be able to climb 2,000 metres per minute and travel up to 400 kilometres per hour. But that's not for another decade, at least.
I'll look forward to flying it.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Listen to the following interview with an expert on environmentally friendly lifestyles and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Welcome to How Green is Your House? Today we have some suggestions from Habiba Phillips, an advisor on how to help save the Earth's resources at home. Habiba, can we really do any good just by making our homes more environmentally friendly?
Yes, of course. And it benefits both you and your family and the world itself.
What is your job then, exactly?
Well, people call me to come and advise them how to become more environmentally friendly in their homes and lifestyles. Also, this often has another benefit for them, in the long run, in that their energy and fuel bills become cheaper. Environmentally friendly housekeeping helps the family finances and also helps nature, I like to think.
That sounds good. Do you work only in people's homes?
Oh, no. That's a small part of my work. I also help businesses, schools and colleges and large organisations. Anyone, in fact, who has property which could be made more environmentally friendly.
What sort of visit do you make to these places?
I call it a green audit. That means I look all over the property and suggest ways of managing it which are more in keeping with the environment. I try to eliminate waste of natural resources, water and heat, for example.
Yes, those are the most obvious examples, aren't they? So what do you do first?
I look in the attic or roof space and see if the property is losing heat there. 50% of the heat from downstairs can be lost through the roof. If it is, I suggest insulation or padding, which will help keep the heat in the house and will also reduce heating bills eventually. The entrance to the attic is also another way in which heat is lost, so I advise people to use old blankets to cover up the gaps.
And what next?
Well, the most common cause of water wastage is when people leave the tap running while they clean their teeth or apply shampoo to their hair. I advise them to turn off the tap. This again helps reduce bills in areas where the use of water is measured and charged accordingly.
Anything else?
Yes, I check that the curtains, blinds or shutters are heavy enough or fit closely enough to keep out draughts and to keep in warmth. I check that internal doors don't have huge gaps underneath them. At certain times of the year, when the chimney is not in use, I recommend a chimney balloon.
Whatever is a chimney balloon?
You push it up the chimney, inflate to the correct size, and it stops heat loss when the chimney is not in use. And it stops cold winds blowing down it too.
What about electric light bulbs? What is your policy on them?
That's very important. I suggest low-energy bulbs throughout the house, and in fact some places will provide these free for you, like your local library perhaps. They can be more expensive to buy, but they last longer than ordinary bulbs and are well worth the investment.
What about places where all the electrical items are plugged into the mains overnight?
Oh, yes. Leaving a television on standby or microwave with a time display on means you often use more electricity than you would in viewing or cooking. So I advise people to turn them off overnight and save money and energy. Also, you can buy saver plugs, which are equivalent to low-energy bulbs. You can use one of these for your fridge, for example.
Would you suggest trying to use as few electrical items as possible?
Yes, of course. If, for example, you can dry your clothes in your garden rather than in a tumble dryer. Also, in the garden, I suggest you collect rainwater and use it for watering plants, and that you make sure that you use compost bins to recycle organic matter. And don't forget to recycle your rubbish. You shouldn't really need a conventional rubbish bin at all, you know.
What a wealth of ideas. Do you have a website where we can check all this out for ourselves?
Yes, I do. It's www.greensolutions.com.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Welcome to How Green is Your House? Today, we have some suggestions from Habiba Phillips, an advisor on how to help save the Earth's resources at home. Habiba, can we really do any good just by making our homes more environmentally friendly?
Yes, of course. And it benefits both you and your family and the world itself.
What is your job then, exactly?
Well, people call me to come and advise them how to become more environmentally friendly in their homes and lifestyles. Also, this often has another benefit for them, in the long run, in that their energy and fuel bills become cheaper. Environmentally friendly housekeeping helps the family finances and also helps nature, I like to think.
That sounds good. Do you work only in people's homes?
Oh no, that's a small part of my work. I also help businesses, schools and colleges and large organisations. Anyone, in fact, who has property which could be made more environmentally friendly.
What sort of visit do you make to these places?
I call it a green audit. That means I look all over the property and suggest ways of managing it which are more in keeping with the environment. I try to eliminate waste of natural resources, water and heat, for example.
Yes, those are the most obvious examples, aren't they? So what do you do first?
I look in the attic or roof space and see if the property is losing heat there. 50% of the heat from downstairs can be lost through the roof. If it is, I suggest insulation or padding, which will help keep the heat in the house, and will also reduce heating bills eventually. The entrance to the attic is also another way in which heat is lost, so I advise people to use old blankets to cover up the gaps.
And what next?
Well, the most common cause of water wastage is when people leave the tap running while they clean their teeth or apply shampoo to their hair. I advise them to turn off the tap. This again helps reduce bills in areas where the use of water is measured and charged accordingly.
Anything else?
Yes, I check that the curtains, blinds or shutters are heavy enough or fit closely enough to keep out drafts and to keep in warmth. I check that internal doors don't have huge gaps underneath them. At certain times of the year, when the chimney is not in use, I recommend a chimney balloon.
Whatever is a chimney balloon?
You push it up the chimney, inflate to the correct size, and it stops heat loss when the chimney is not in use. And it stops cold winds blowing down it too.
What about electric light bulbs? What is your policy on them?
That's very important. I suggest low-energy bulbs throughout the house, and in fact some places will provide these free for you, like your local library perhaps. They can be more expensive to buy, but they last longer than ordinary bulbs and are well worth the investment.
What about places where all the electrical items are plugged into the mains overnight?
Oh, yes. Leaving a television on standby or microwave with a time display on means you often use more electricity than you would in viewing or cooking. So I advise people to turn them off overnight and save money and energy. Also, you can buy saver plugs, which are equivalent to low-energy bulbs. You can use one of these for your fridge, for example.
Would you suggest trying to use as few electrical items as possible?
Yes, of course. If, for example, you can dry your clothes in your garden rather than in a tumble dryer. Also, in the garden, I suggest you collect rainwater and use it for watering plants, and that you make sure that you use compost bins to recycle organic matter. And don't forget to recycle your rubbish. You shouldn't really need a conventional rubbish bin at all, you know.
What a wealth of ideas. Do you have a website where we can check all this out for ourselves?
Yes, I do. It's www.greensolutions.com.
You'll hear part of a radio programme about bags for walkers. For questions 9 to 18, complete the sentences. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 2.
And now for a few tips for those of you who are going to go walking this summer. Let's look first of all at the type of bag that you should take with you. Rod Smith works in a shop that sells camping equipment, and he feels he has a bag for every type of walking holiday. Rod, does it really make a difference what type of bag you use?
Yes, Jill, it certainly does. Bags come in every shape, colour and size now. So it makes sense to pick one that is right for your needs. A backpack, for example, could quite rapidly ruin an otherwise good walking holiday if it doesn't fit your back. In fact, the fit is critical, but the choice is so large now that it's difficult to know how to make the right one. So here are a few things to look for. First of all, size. A bag that holds 35 litres and has 3 outside pockets should be plenty big enough for a day trip. For a 4 to 5 day walking tour, I would recommend a bag that holds 70 litres for a man and 50 to 60 litres for a woman. That's along with a tent and a sleeping bag. An upright bag, that's one that closes at the top, is better if you intend to climb a lot of hills. What about the contents? Well, in order to really avoid the inconvenience of broken containers or crushed clothes, I suggest you go for a bag with a solid bottom. The best ones, but these are probably the most expensive, have a leather base that's particularly resistant to wear and tear. A bag that has two compartments inside will allow you to find things more easily and separate out items such as creams that could leak in hot weather. Extra pockets on the outside of the bag are also useful if you want to carry any tools for climbing that are sharp or get dirty when you use them. Then you have to think about carrying your bag. If it's a backpack, a wide cushioned belt will ease the strain on your back and hips and leave you with more energy for your walking activities. Shoulder straps also help lighten the load, and these should be easy to adjust. There are many different types of strap on the market that can be adjusted in various different ways. Try several and compare them. It's also a good idea to make sure there's a horizontal bar that goes across your shoulders and stops the straps from falling off. Well, if you choose your bag carefully and think about some of the things I've mentioned, you shouldn't waste your money. Finally, make sure there are plenty of air holes in the padded part of your bag that touches your body. These are essential to allow sweat to escape and to make your walking or climbing holiday a comfortable one.
Now you'll hear part two again.
And now for a few tips for those of you who are going to go walking this summer. Let's look first of all at the type of bag that you should take with you. Rod Smith works in a shop that sells camping equipment, and he feels he has a bag for every type of walking holiday. Rod, does it really make a difference what type of bag you use?
Yes, Jill, it certainly does. Bags come in every shape, colour and size now, so it makes sense to pick one that is right for your needs. A backpack, for example, could quite rapidly ruin an otherwise good walking holiday if it doesn't fit your back. In fact, the fit is critical, but the choice is so large now that it's difficult to know how to make the right one. So, here are a few things to look for. First of all, size. A bag that holds 35 litres and has three outside pockets should be plenty big enough for a day trip. For a 4 to 5 day walking tour, I would recommend a bag that holds 70 litres for a man and 50 to 60 litres for a woman. That's along with a tent and a sleeping bag. An upright bag, that's one that closes at the top, is better if you intend to climb a lot of hills. What about the contents? Well, in order to really avoid the inconvenience of broken containers or crushed clothes, I suggest you go for a bag with a solid bottom. The best ones, but these are probably the most expensive, have a leather base that's particularly resistant to wear and tear. A bag that has two compartments inside will allow you to find things more easily and separate out items such as creams that could leak in hot weather. Extra pockets on the outside of the bag are also useful if you want to carry any tools for climbing that are sharp or get dirty when you use them. Then you have to think about carrying your bag. If it's a backpack, a wide cushioned belt will ease the strain on your back and hips and leave you with more energy for your walking activities. Shoulder straps also help lighten the load, and these should be easy to adjust. There are many different types of strap on the market that can be adjusted in various different ways. Try several and compare them. It's also a good idea to make sure there's a horizontal bar that goes across your shoulders and stops the straps from falling off. Well, if you choose your bag carefully and think about some of the things I've mentioned, you shouldn't waste your money. Finally, make sure there are plenty of air holes in the padded part of your bag that touches your body. These are essential to allow sweat to escape and to make your walking or climbing holiday a comfortable one.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You'll hear five different students who are studying away from home. They are talking about their accommodation. For questions 19 to 23, choose from the list A to F what each speaker says about their accommodation. Use the letters only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You now have 30 seconds in which to look at part three. Speaker 1.
I'd requested college accommodation, so when I was offered it, I was really pleased. I didn't fancy having to look after myself. Too many other things to do, lessons and homework and going out with friends. I knew what the rules were, in by 10, no noise after 9, and I didn't mind them at first. But they've started to annoy me more and more, and now I can't wait to get out and be able to do my own thing. I don't think I'll be recommending this place to anyone else.
Speaker 2.
It's exciting leaving home and becoming independent. I've been staying with some relatives for the past year. I'd stayed with them before, so when I knew I was coming here to study, they said, "Why don't you come and live with us?" Great. And they've been fine. Let me do whatever I want and haven't stuck to rigid meal times and all that sort of thing. So I've been able to meet plenty of people and get to know the area and the course and so on. I feel a part of it all now, but I'm always ready to try something different.
Speaker 3.
I was pretty calm about coming here, but I couldn't decide whether to stay with a family or get my own flat. I talked to other people, you know, friends who've studied away from home before, and they all recommended that I should get a flat because you have so much more freedom. So I did that. I'd only been here 2 weeks, and I went out one day and left the front door unlocked. When I got back, I found that my camera had been stolen. I suppose I was lucky it was just that. I'm a bit more careful now.
Speaker 4.
My friend Benny and I started the course at the same time. There was never any doubt that we'd share a place. It was the obvious choice for us to make, and I think it's definitely the best option. Of course, you have to think about what you're going to eat, have some kind of system for cleaning, a few ground rules. We get annoyed with each other at times. Benny smokes, and I had to ask him to go outside, which he does now. It hasn't all been straightforward, but overall, I prefer the independence this place gives me.
Speaker 5.
My sister came here before me and studied at the same college. She told my parents that it would be much better if I stayed with her, and then she could look after me, help me settle down here, that kind of thing. So, that's what happened. Nobody asked me what I wanted to do. Well, the truth is, we don't get on badly, but I never seem to see the other students that I study with, which is a big disadvantage. I think it's better to force yourself to find your own way in a new environment.
Now you'll hear part three again. Speaker 1.
I'd requested college accommodation, so when I was offered it, I was really pleased. I didn't fancy having to look after myself. Too many other things to do, lessons and homework and going out with friends. I knew what the rules were, in by 10, no noise after 9, and I didn't mind them at first. But they've started to annoy me more and more, and now I can't wait to get out and be able to do my own thing. I don't think I'll be recommending this place to anyone else.
Speaker 2.
It's exciting leaving home and becoming independent. I've been staying with some relatives for the past year. I'd stayed with them before, so when I knew I was coming here to study, they said, "Why don't you come and live with us?" Great. And they've been fine. let me do whatever I want and haven't stuck to rigid meal times and all that sort of thing. So I've been able to meet plenty of people and get to know the area and the course and so on. I feel a part of it all now, but I'm always ready to try something different.
Speaker 3.
I was pretty calm about coming here, but I couldn't decide whether to stay with a family or get my own flat. I talked to other people, you know, friends who've studied away from home before, and they all recommended that I should get a flat because you have so much more freedom. So I did that. I'd only been here 2 weeks, and I went out one day and left the front door unlocked. When I got back, I found that my camera had been stolen. I suppose I was lucky it was just that. I'm a bit more careful now.
Speaker 4.
My friend Benny and I started the course at the same time. There was never any doubt that we'd share a place. It was the obvious choice for us to make, and I think it's definitely the best option. Of course, you have to think about what you're going to eat, have some kind of system for cleaning, a few ground rules. We get annoyed with each other at times. Benny smokes, and I had to ask him to go outside, which he does now. It hasn't all been straightforward, but overall, I prefer the independence this place gives me.
Speaker 5.
My sister came here before me and studied at the same college. She told my parents that it would be much better if I stayed with her, and then she could look after me, help me settle down here, that kind of thing. So, that's what happened. Nobody asked me what I wanted to do. Well, the truth is, we don't get on badly, but I never seem to see the other students that I study with, which is a big disadvantage. I think it's better to force yourself to find your own way in a new environment.
That's the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. You'll hear part of a radio interview in which Tina White, a magazine editor, talks about her life and work. For questions 24 to 30, choose the best answer A, B or C. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part 4.
Tina White, some people describe you as the best magazine editor in the world, and you're only in your 30s. Can you tell us how you started your amazing career?
Well, when I was 20, still at college, I was asked to write a weekly column for a local paper. The paper had wanted me to write about famous people, you know, their wonderful lifestyles, the sort of thing people like to read about. Instead, what I did was to concentrate on people who the general public didn't know, but who had something original to say.
And you got away with it. Now, at that early stage, your family was important. How far did they influence your career choice?
My father was a film producer, and my childhood was spent around international actors and directors. So, with such influences, I should have become an actress, something my father would have loved. But no, I chose to be a journalist in spite of the wishes of my family. I think the biggest influence was my school. Not so much the people, but the materials it gave me access to. The hours and hours spent at the library.
From being a journalist, you then went on to become an editor. I understand the first magazine you edited, Female Focus, wasn't much of a success.
Well, I was the editor for a year and then I resigned, mainly because of disagreements with the owners. They were reluctant to change things because they had faith it would eventually make a profit. But when you think of it, the magazine had been losing millions of pounds a year before I became its editor. When I left, it was still losing money, but nothing like as much as previously. Also, when I took over, it was selling around 650,000 copies. That soon increased to 800,000, so it was certainly an improvement.
Mm. And now you're editing Woman's World, and you've made it the best-selling women's magazine ever. How do you make people want to read it?
For some of my competitors, the most important point is what you put on the cover of your magazine. But they forget faithful readers look beyond that. The real challenge is, how do you encourage a reader to read a serious piece? How are we going to make it an article that people want to read? You have to get their attention, and nothing does that better than a very lively, even shocking, opening line.
It's said that you work very hard because you don't trust your employees.
That was the case 5 years ago when I was appointed. It almost drove me mad. I knew I had the right idea, for example, but I wasn't able to get it done because I didn't have the brilliant writers I have now, or the right staff to read all the material when it came in. I had to read everything about 6 times, and that was awful. It took me 4 years to put together the team I wanted, and it would be very unfair to say I don't trust them.
Do you sometimes worry that you might lose your fame and wealth?
Yes. When you work as an editor, you're praised today and criticised tomorrow.
Mm.
Of course, it would be difficult to live without all the, well, material comforts I'm used to, but a smaller income is something I think I could cope with. It wouldn't be the end of the world. Much more serious would be if the people I work with no longer admired my work, and most of all, I want it to stay that way.
And what about the future?
Well, people often think I have planned my career very carefully, but in fact, lots of things have happened by chance. Lots of opportunities have come my way, and I was once asked to edit a book series. As a youngster, one of my dreams was to be a writer, to write a novel that would become a bestseller and then an award-winning film. Well, it may seem silly, but I still hope that will happen one day.
Tina, thank you very much for joining us today.
Now you'll hear part four again.
Tina White, some people describe you as the best magazine editor in the world, and you're only in your 30s. Can you tell us how you started your amazing career?
Well, when I was 20, still at college, I was asked to write a weekly column for a local paper. The paper had wanted me to write about famous people, you know, their wonderful lifestyles, the sort of thing people like to read about. Instead, what I did was to concentrate on people who the general public didn't know, but who had something original to say.
And you got away with it. Now, at that early stage, your family was important. How far did they influence your career choice?
My father was a film producer, and my childhood was spent around international actors and directors. So, with such influences, I should have become an actress, something my father would have loved. But no, I chose to be a journalist in spite of the wishes of my family. I think the biggest influence was my school. Not so much the people, but the materials it gave me access to. The hours and hours spent at the library.
From being a journalist, you then went on to become an editor. I understand the first magazine you edited, Female Focus, wasn't much of a success.
Well, I was the editor for a year and then I resigned, mainly because of disagreements with the owners. They were reluctant to change things because they had faith it would eventually make a profit. But when you think of it, the magazine had been losing millions of pounds a year before I became its editor. When I left, it was still losing money, but nothing like as much as previously. Also, when I took over, it was selling around 650,000 copies. That soon increased to 800,000, so it was certainly an improvement.
Mm. And now you're editing Woman's World, and you've made it the best-selling women's magazine ever. How do you make people want to read it?
For some of my competitors, the most important point is what you put on the cover of your magazine. But they forget faithful readers look beyond that. The real challenge is, how do you encourage a reader to read a serious piece? How are we going to make it an article that people want to read? You have to get their attention, and nothing does that better than a very lively, even shocking opening line.
It's said that you work very hard because you don't trust your employees.
That was the case 5 years ago when I was appointed. It almost drove me mad. I knew I had the right idea, for example, but I wasn't able to get it done because I didn't have the brilliant writers I have now or the right staff to read all the material when it came in. I had to read everything about 6 times, and that was awful. It took me 4 years to put together the team I wanted, and it would be very unfair to say I don't trust them.
Do you sometimes worry that you might lose your fame and wealth?
Yes. When you work as an editor, you're praised today and criticised tomorrow. Mm. Of course, it would be difficult to live without all the, well, material comforts I'm used to, but a smaller income is something I think I could cope with. It wouldn't be the end of the world. Much more serious would be if the people I work with no longer admired my work, and most of all, I want it to stay that way.
And what about the future?
Well, people often think I have planned my career very carefully, but in fact, lots of things have happened by chance. Lots of opportunities have come my way, and I was once asked to edit a book series. As a youngster, one of my dreams was to be a writer, to write a novel that would become a bestseller and then an award-winning film. Well, it may seem silly, but I still hope that will happen one day.
Tina, thank you very much for joining us today.
That's the end of part 4. There'll now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. I'll remind you when there is 1 minute left so that you're sure to finish in time. That's the end of the test. Please stop now. Your supervisor will now collect all the question papers and answer sheets.